Hello, this is Mark Ryer, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 20th issue of the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, getting started. First article, Trump's order to cut military exercises with South Korea carries risks, as experts say. President Trump's decision to curtail the military exercises came as allies questioned the U.S. commitment to long-standing alliances. For years, the U.S. and South Korea militaries have participated in one of the largest military exercises in the world, with thousands of troops from both countries preparing for possible North Korea aggression. On President Trump's orders, the Pentagon curtailed this year's exercises and scaled back some live-fire components of the drill, which were already underway. Current and former military officials say the move is likely to undercut U.S. military readiness in the region at a time when allies are questioning the Trump administration's commitment to long-standing partnership and countering China. The president's decision is also unlikely to affect the person he hoped to sway, North Korea's dictator, Kim Jong-un. The exercises, called Ulchi Freedom Shield, usually run for 11 days and have sometimes included 17,000 or more U.S. troops and 50,000 South Korean troops. In past years, the sessions have featured some computer simulations carried out in a large bunker south of the capital, Seoul, intended to check the Allies' readiness to repel a North Korean attack. This year, some 18,000 South Korean troops were to take part in Ulchi Freedom Shield. The Pentagon has not said how many American troops had been expected to participate. While both countries have insisted that the exercises were defensive in nature, Mr. Kim has long called them provocative. North Korea's foreign ministry has condemned the drills as a rehearsal for an aggressive war. The country conducted two ballistic missile tests off its east coast this month, vowing to respond to a new level of a threat with a new level of a deterrent. Mr. Trump seemed to agree with North Korea, saying in a post on Sunday that the country under Mr. Kim had been unthreatening and respectful while he has been president. American troops have been through this before. Mr. Trump abruptly canceled the exercise in 2018 during his first administration without notifying Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. At the time, Trump administration officials said they wanted to give negotiations meant to rein in North Korea's nuclear ambitions an opportunity to succeed. Mr. Trump met with Mr. Kim three times, but ultimately failed in that goal. Back then, officials said the military could weather one big interruption in the exercise scheduled, but that readiness would suffer if the drill lapsed for several years. After Mr. Trump's announcement on Sunday, the Pentagon declined to say which specific training events would be canceled, modified, or conducted through computer simulation. But former commanders said two main components would be affected: the testing of high-level command problems and other issues, and training for large-scale, on-the-ground live fire and troop maneuvering. Both are valuable from a military readiness perspective, commanders said. A Pentagon official who spoke on the condition of remaining anonymous to discuss operational matters said the American and South Korean militaries would continue training on their own before the exercise ends on August 21st, but that they would not train together, as had been previously scheduled. Of course, it hurts readiness, said Victor Cha, the Korea chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. and readiness relates to deterrence. If the Chinese or North Koreans feel that U.S. deterrence is not as strong, they might think there are opportunities there. Mr. Cha also disputed the notion that canceling the exercises would help Mr. Trump to get a nuclear deal with North Korea, pointing to the 2018 talks that ultimately collapsed in Hanoi in 2019 over disagreement about relief from U.S. economic sanctions and the hope and the scope of North Korea's nuclear disarmament. General Curtis Scaparata, a retired top commander of U.S. forces in South Korea, said that scaling back live fire training hurts troops' ability to hone in their combat skills. It develops competence and confidence by training just as you would fight an adversary as a team, he said in an email. The use of live rounds and rigorous training standards in training is the most realistic test of unit readiness. In a rambling social media post on Sunday, Mr. Trump complained that South Korea had not supported the Trump administration in its war against Iran. He also said the military exercises were expensive, with much of these costs paid for by the United States of America, as usual. The estimated cost of this year's exercise was $6.9 million, the Pentagon officials said, adding that any savings resulted from the changes have not yet been determined. But former commanders said the vast majority of these costs have already been paid for expenses like U.S. troop movements in and out of South Korea. South Korea's foreign ministry appeared to be caught off guard by Mr. Trump's announcement, but pledged to continue coordinating with the United States on the military exercises. As the war with Iran sinks into a quagmire, Mr. Trump is increasingly refocused on North Korea, which is now a de facto nuclear power. Mr. Trump posted a picture of himself with the North Korean leader on social media at least twice in recent months. Kim Jong-un and I get along great, Mr. Trump wrote alongside a photograph he posted on Saturday of their meeting at the border between North and South Korea in 2019. Mr. Trump said on Wednesday that he planned to meet with Mr. Kim sometime later this year, but he did not offer details. I get along with Kim Jong-un very well, Mr. Trump said. He's going to be fine. As long as we have a smart president, he's going to be fine. Kim Yo-young, the North Korea's leader, Younger's sister and close advisor, told state media on Wednesday that the country's position towards the United States had not changed despite Mr. Trump's decision to cut short the military exercises. Okay, next article. How the $32 trillion Treasury market influences the economy. Interest rates on U.S. government bonds can affect everything from auto and student loans to mortgages. Investors are worried about the amount of debt the government has piled up, and bond yields are one key indicator showing this. Yields, or interest rates, on the 30-year Treasury rose above 5.3%, a nearly two-decade high, fueled by anxiety over the war in Iran, inflation, unstable government deficits, and rampant spending on artificial intelligence. The nearly $32 trillion market for U.S. government bonds, called the Treasury market, offers a clear signal of where the economy may be headed. More specifically, it's the yield of the 10-year Treasury note that tends to send the temperature for consumer interest rates, including mortgages and auto loans. They can affect everything from student loans to the housing market. The yield on the 30-year Treasury moves in sync with the 10-year bond. Here's a guide to understand what is happening with Treasury yields right now and why it matters. Excuse me. What is a bond? Well, first, the basics. A bond is a form of fixed income debt, which means that when it is issued, someone is borrowing money and someone else is lending it. In the U.S. government bond market, a borrower is the federal government, and the bonds are called treasuries. Other governments do this too. In Britain, they're called gilts. And in Japan, they're known as JGBs, which stands for Japanese government bonds. The United States issues debt with a range of maturities, a term that refers to when it has to be paid back. Treasury bills are short-term debt obligations, ranging from 4 weeks to a year. Treasury notes are medium-term, maturing between 2 and 10 years. And Treasury bonds mature in 20 or 30 years. The leader is the bond investor, the lender is the bond investor, who expects to be paid interest on the investment. That's a key difference between a bond and other assets that people buy or trade, like stocks. The bond's yield is the total annual return someone can expect to earn from it. A bond's yield rises as its price falls and vice versa. Similar to the rate a homeowner pays on a mortgage, a bond yield reflects a variety of factors. When the debt will be repaid, the risk that it won't be, the investor's view on whether earnings on the loan will be more worthwhile than other investments, like stocks and cryptocurrencies. When an investor owns a treasury bond until it matures, the return the investor will receive is fixed. But because government bonds are publicly traded, their value can rise or fall just like a stock price. And that means yields move higher or lower too. Higher yields means investors are demanding a higher return to make the investment worth it to them. So why are bond yields rising? Often, it's the 10-year Treasury note that gets a lot of attention. It has been climbing since late February, when the yield sat at 3.96%, although the rise began reversing in April and then again in May. The yield began rocketing back up by the end of June. It's currently 4.66%. The rise has been less steep than previous runs, like when President Trump announced sweeping tariffs in April last year. But investors are aware of a cocktail of forces unlikely to rein in climbing yields. The flip-flopping on a peace deal in Iran continues to rock oil markets, which in turn adds worries over inflation numbers and affordability. Paired with what rampant spending by tech companies and on AI, which has left some analysts guessing that the hype has drawn investors away from bonds, and others saying the enthusiasm has pumped up growth and inflation expectations. The Treasury buyer is now much more price sensitive, meaning investors are demanding a higher yield to absorb both government and corporate insurance, said Jason Goldberg, a Barclays analyst. He wrote that in a note. Some analysts said a recent pullback in the equity market was a sign stock investors were growing more worried about bond yields, too. Typically, bond prices and stocks move inversely. When stocks fall, investors move to a safer investment, like government bonds, to protect from losses. That negative correlation persists for the first two decades of the 21st century, but has recently flipped. The correlation, now positive, is at its highest level since 1990s, Bank of America analysts said in a research note on Wednesday. That flipped correlation means bonds don't hedge losses the same way they used to, because when stocks fall, so do bond prices. Investors are no longer willing to pay the same premium for an asset class that offers lower hedging utility, the Bank of America analysts wrote. So how do rising yields affect the economy? One reason the 10-year yield gets so much attention is that it is its starting point from which lenders determine mortgage rates, which means that as it rises, taking out a loan to buy a home becomes more expensive. Excuse me. As of Wednesday, the average interest rate on a 30-year mortgage was 6.67%. up from roughly 6% earlier in the year, according to data from Freddie Mac. How do rising yields predict what might happen next in the economy? Because treasuries are issued in varying maturities, each set offers predictions for what will happen in the economy at different time periods. Typically, the longer the horizon for an investment, the more bond investors expect to be paid in interest. We have more certainty about how things will go over the next 3 months than we do about the next decade. So the yield on a 10-year Treasury note is usually higher than the yield on one that matures in just a few months or a couple years. When that relationship reverses during periods of increased economic anxiety, as it did in 2022, it is used as a recession indicator because the risk in the near term eclipses the long-term risk. Although yields have room to rise modestly higher, the uptick isn't yet a cause for alarms about buyer strikes or a dysfunctional market, according to a Wednesday note by LPL Financial's chief fixed income strategist, Lawrence Gillam. The demand for bonds, at least at last week's three 10 and 30-year auctions, was decent, Mr. Gillam said. The market is absorbing the paper, he said. That is the mechanism we would expect in a normalization. Higher yields recruit buyers. In a crisis, higher yields chase them away. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, next article. As Iran and U.S. settle into an uneasy standoff, who will blink first? For weeks, there has been no diplomatic progress, but also no full-scale fighting, as both sides seem to believe they can hold out longer than the other. They are not seriously negotiating, nor are they shooting at each other. Instead, Iran and the United States have settled into an uneasy, in-between state that risks either a return to fighting or a hardening stalemate. At the core of this unresolved status are calculations, perhaps miscalculations, by each side. Iranian officials believe they have more to gain from withstanding U.S. economic pressure and maintaining control over the Strait of Hormuz than they do from making major concessions in a negotiated deal, analysts said. And the United States appears to be betting that putting Iran in a tighter economic stranglehold will succeed where military strikes have not. On Wednesday, President Trump vowed to impose tremendous economic consequences on countries that do business with Iran. So far, neither the U.S. nor Iran has gotten what they want. When the countries agreed to a ceasefire 2 months ago, it was supposed to put them on a path to a broader deal within 60 days, covering Iran's nuclear program and the lifting of U.S. sanctions. That deadline passed this week, and on Tuesday, Mr. Trump said on social media that there were no talks or conversations going on or scheduled. Instead, the two countries are in a state of constant limbo, said Nicole Grajewski, an assistant professor at the Center for International Studies at Sciences Po in Paris. Not that much has fundamentally changed over the past several months, she added, beyond a further entrenchment of the Iranian position and repeated, so far unsuccessful, U.S. efforts to find some kind of way out. This month, Tehran issued a list of demands on Washington for reopening the Strait of Hormuz, which sits along Iran's southern coast and is a major transit point for most of the world's oil. The demands included the removal of sanctions, the release of frozen assets, and the payment of war reparations. Similar conditions were previously mentioned as being part of a possible future deal between the two sides, outlined in a memorandum of understanding that was agreed in June but quickly unraveled. For weeks, Iran has been negotiating with Oman over future management of the strait, but the list of demands suggested that even in the event of a deal, Iranian forces would continue to threaten and attack transiting marine traffic. At least two ships have been attacked in the strait in recent days. Having recovered from the initial shock of the war, Tehran is now determined to demonstrate strength, said Mehzad Barjoudi, Dean of the College of Arts, Sciences, and Education at Missouri University of Science and Technology. Its weaponization of the Strait of Hormuz and hardline bargaining is in parallel talks with the United States and Oman should be understood in that context, he added. Over the past few months, President Trump's rhetoric has swung between threats of annihilation and promises that a diplomatic deal was close. If that approach was meant to scare Iranian officials into making concessions, it seems to have had the opposite effect. They appear to have become convinced that Mr. Trump is unwilling to fully relaunch a war that threatens to raise oil prices and has been unpopular with the American people, especially before midterm elections. Iran appears to believe the United States will eventually tire of an expensive, open-ended confrontation, says Alex Vatanka, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, a Washington-based research organization. At the same time, the United States has emphasized the economic pressure on Iran. Mr. Trump's son-in-law and envoy, Jared Kushner, told Fox News on Monday that Iranian officials were not showing any interest in doing something that makes sense for us. When asked where talks stood, he pointed to a naval blockade aimed at further hobbling Iran's economy as Mr. Trump's current focus. On Tuesday, Mr. Trump said on social media that the blockade remained in full effect. He also asserted that the strait was fully open, even as maritime officials noted the attacks on ships recently. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said in an interview with Newsmax recently that his department planned to apply measures that have never been seen in the history of the economic isolation of a country. Iran's rulers have surveyed international economic pressures before. They've survived them. Though they did agree to concessions on their nuclear program in 2015 after ratcheting up of sanctions during the Obama administration. Given Tehran's stance so far, the immediate cost of sanctions will most likely be borne by the Iranian people, who are already contending with sky-high inflation and struggling to afford basic goods. In the face of American sanctions, Iran will try to transfer the resulting economic pain onto its population for as long as possible, betting that Washington will blink first. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Mujtaba Khamenei, has appointed hardline loyalists to key military positions, signaling his intent to keep the country on a war footing. A renowned conflagration would probably drag the country into energy infrastructure, U.S. bases in the Middle East, and commercial shipping. For now, it appears just as likely that the stalemate will continue with the core issues unresolved, including Iran's nuclear program and the Strait of Hormuz. The longer this limbo persists, the more entrenched it becomes, and the harder it is to construct an off-ramp that either side can present as anything other than a concession. Okay, and now on to an article, similar topic. Oil prices jump after Trump's latest Iran threat. Oil prices rose to their highest levels in a month on Thursday after President Trump claimed he would level tremendous economic consequences on the countries that did business with Iran. Without naming countries or details on possible actions, Mr. Trump said on social media on Wednesday, suggested he would target countries that buy Iranian oil. A U.S. Navy blockade has already cut off Iran's seaborne oil exports. High oil prices have fueled fears about inflation, with the cost of gasoline, diesel, and other products derived from crude oil up sharply since the start of the war in Iran nearly 6 months ago. This anxiety has also been reflected in bond market volatility. Oil prices rise. The price of Brent crude, the global benchmark for oil, was up more than 3% to more than $94 a barrel. West Texas Intermediate crude, the U.S. benchmark, was around $87 a barrel. Investors and analysts are focused on the continued disruption to shipping in the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow waterway between Iran and Oman that is a vital trading route for oil and natural gas that normally carries as much as one-fifth of the world's oil supply. Stocks are steady, though. Futures on the S&P 500 pointed to a slight increase when stocks resumed trading in the U.S. and the United States on Thursday. In Europe, the Stoxx 600, a broad index that tracks the region's largest companies, was little changed. Stocks in Asia were broadly higher, carrying over a U.S. rally from the day before. The Kospi index in South Korea surged 5.9%, while the Nikkei 225 in Japan jumped 1.4%. Bond rally fades, though. The yields on U.S. government bonds rose on Thursday as the effects of the Treasury Department's latest effort to rein in borrowing costs began to fade. The 10-year Treasury yield, a widely influential interest rate that underpins mortgages, business loans, and many other types of debt, rose to 4.67%, erasing much of the decline in yields on the previous day when the Treasury doubled the amount of debt it was authorized to buy back from investors in weekly operations. Investors are worried about the war in Iran's effect on inflation. Large government deficits and ramping borrowing to finance artificial intelligence infrastructure, which have all put upward pressures on yields. Gasoline prices ticked up. Gas prices rose on Thursday to a national average of $4.10 a gallon, according to AAA Motor Club. The increase has raised the cost for drivers by 38% since the war began. Gas prices don't move in lockstep with crude, usually trailing increases or drops by a few days. The average prices of diesel rose 5 cents to $5.55 on Thursday, up 48% since the start of the war. Okay, let's move on. Next article. Harry and Meghan's break with Britain and planned return. This is a timeline for that. The couple will remain non-working royals. It is unclear where they will live. Prince Harry and his wife, Meghan, the Duke of and and Duchess of Sussex are moving back to Britain more than 6 years after leaving behind their lives as working members of the royal family and moving to the United States. The couple began dating about a decade ago and married in 2018. She is an American actress, 3 years his senior, biracial, divorced, and vocal about her views. And their union seemed to usher in a new, more inclusive, modern era for the British royal family. They have two children, Prince Archie, born in London in May of 2019, and Princess Lilibet, born in California in June of 2021. The couple struggled with the attention and pressure on them in Britain, where the press targeted the Duchess and chose to leave in 2020. Here's the timeline of the break with the royals' roles and with Britain and the American life they have led since. In October 2019, Meghan and Prince Harry say they were taking 6 weeks off from royal duties later in the year and soon after celebrate their newborn son's first Christmas on Vancouver Island in Canada, privately. In retrospect, the holiday hinted at things to come. In January of 2020, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex announced their intentions to carve out a progressive new role in the British monarchy, saying they will step back as senior members of the royal family and work to become financially independent while continuing to fully support Her Majesty the Queen. They did not get clearance for their announcement from Queen Elizabeth II, and their remarks set off a crisis in the royal family. Buckingham Palace says soon after that, the couple will stop using their loftiest royal titles, giving up state funding and repaying at least $3 million in taxpayer money that has been used to refurbish their official residence at Windsor Castle. In March of 2020, the couple takes part in their final engagement as working royals. As of March 31st, they are no longer full-time working members of the House of Windsor. In September 2020, the couple, having resettled in California, unveiled new Hollywood careers. They found a production company, later named Archewell Productions, and signed a multi-year deal with Netflix to make documentaries, docu-series, feature films, scripted shows, and children's programming. In February 2021, a little more than a year after announcing their plans to step back from the royal duties, Buckingham Palace announces that Harry and Meghan confirmed to Her Majesty the Queen that they would not be returning as working members of the royal family. Queen Elizabeth II had made clear she would not tolerate a half-in, half-out arrangement with the couple. In March of 2021, in a bombshell interview with Oprah Winfrey on CBS, Meghan reveals that she struggled with suicidal thoughts after her marriage, describing a royal life that began as a fairy tale but quickly turned suffocating and cruel. She raises issues of race and privilege in the most rarefied echelon in British society in an interview that shines an awkward and at times unflattering light on the British royal family. Then in June of 2021, Princess Lilibet of Sussex, Prince Harry and Meghan's second child, is born in the California hospital. June of 2022, Prince Harry and Meghan attend Queen Elizabeth's Platinum Jubilee together in Britain. In September of 2022, Queen Elizabeth II dies, and Mary and Meghan attend the funeral, where Meghan's every move is scrutinized, particularly following revelations over the years of tensions between her and her husband and his brother, Prince William, and his wife, Kate Middleton. In December of 2022, Meghan and Prince Harry's Netflix docuseries premieres, with the couple revealing either ever more about their difficulties with relatives and particularly with the British press. January of 2023, Prince Harry releases his memoir, Spare, revealing his own struggles with members of his family. In May of 2023, Prince Harry attends the coronation of his father, King Charles III, without his wife, who stayed in the United States. He left shortly after the event. Now in March of 2025, Meghan launches a lifestyle show on Netflix called With Love, Meghan, that shows her cooking, gardening, and hanging out with friends. It airs for 2 seasons, followed by a Christmas special. This past March, Meghan's accompanying lifestyle brand as ever, and Netflix announces a brand is going independent. In August of 2025, the production company for the Sussexes signs a new Netflix deal worth less for the royals than their last arrangement. Then in July of 2026, the Duke and Justice and their 2 children meet for the first time in years with King Charles III and Queen Camilla, according to Buckingham Palace. The visit, a sign of a détente between Harry and his father, prompts speculation about whether the couple is making its way back in the fold. And then finally, in August of 2026, Prince Harry and his family are moving back to Britain in the upcoming weeks. 2 people familiar with their decisions told the Times. King Charles III was informed of the decision earlier, though it was not discussed when the Duke and Justice visited Britain over the summer. Harry and Meghan will remain non-working royals. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, next article. From COVID to cancer, how Moderna's stock jumped 177% in a day. The company's fortunes cratered as demand for COVID-19 vaccines plummeted, but it was busy working on something else. COVID vaccines made Moderna a household name, but the company's fortunes cratered as demand for the shots plummeted. Hostility from the Trump administration also spooked investors. As of Tuesday, the company's stock had fallen nearly 90% from its peak, a loss of $170 billion in market value. All the while, the company was quietly mounting a comeback in cancer. On Wednesday, those efforts began to pay off in a big way. Moderna and the big drug maker Merck reported that their experimental cancer vaccine extended the time before melanoma reoccurred in a clinical trial. The first late-stage study of its kind to succeed. The 2 drug makers announced their success in news releases without providing numbers that would indicate how much patients had benefited. Moderna's stock closed up 177% on Wednesday. The investors were betting that Moderna could help jumpstart a new approach to treating certain cancers. The experimental vaccine uses the same messenger RNA or mRNA technology that powered Moderna's COVID-19 shot, but it works differently to treat cancer. Tailored to each patient's tumor genetics, the vaccine delivers instructions to produce a fragment of a tumor to teach the body's immune system to attack the cancer. Cancer vaccines using mRNA could become a hugely lucrative business if the approach works across cancer types. Cutting-edge cancer drugs typically cost several $100,000 a year. For Moderna, cancer is by far the most significant pipeline opportunity, said Tyler Van Buren, an analyst at the Wall Street Bank TD Cowen. Moderna's chief executive, Stephanie Benchel, said on CNBC on Wednesday that the company's work on the cancer vaccine was its latest effort to take very big scientific clinical bets. The prospect of using mRNA vaccines to treat cancer has tantalized researchers for decades, but momentum in the field has accelerated only recently, as manufacturing and other technology has improved, thanks in part to investments during the pandemic. As of last year, more than 60 cancer vaccines using mRNA or similar technology were in development, being tested in more than 120 clinical trials, according to one count. Many of those studies are funded by philanthropies, the government, and smaller biotechnology companies. Four major drug makers are leading the development efforts. Two are Moderna and Merck, whose collaboration on the approach dates back decades. They are also testing the same vaccine as a therapy for cancers of the lung, kidney, and bladder. In the study, whose results were announced on Wednesday, the cancer vaccine was given in combination with Keytruda, Merck's blockbuster cancer immunotherapy. BioNTech, another developer of an mRNA vaccine for COVID, is working with Roche's Genentech unit to develop a vaccine to treat cancers of the pancreas and the colon. Results from a small safety study of that therapy in pancreatic cancer generated excitement this spring. The approach has historically been seen as risky. The manufacturing is complex. The politics are fraught, and there had been little evidence it would work. Other large major cancer drug makers like Pfizer and Bristol Myers are not working on mRNA vaccines for cancer. Under Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Trump administration has made a series of funding and policy changes hostile to mRNA technology. A year ago, the federal government canceled nearly $500 million worth of contracts and other funding for mRNA technology. These political headwinds were serious, and it caused a lot of companies to take great pause, said Jeff Koller, a scientist who works on mRNA at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Koller advises several small mRNA companies and is on the executive committee for the Alliance of mRNA Medicines, which is a trade group. But the administration has signaled it may be more open when it comes to mRNA for treating cancer. This year, it quietly started a public-private partnership expected to fund clinical trials of different cancer vaccines, according to those using mRNA. The Department of Health and Human Services did not return a request for comment on Wednesday about the status of that initiative and how much funding the department has granted. Moderna was founded in 2010 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to develop medicines using mRNA. Its COVID vaccine, its first product, brought in tens of billions of dollars of revenue during the pandemic. But as the public and the government soured on its COVID shot, Moderna had hardly anything to replace it with. Over the past few years, Moderna looked for different ways to reinvent itself. It won approvals for mRNA vaccines for respiratory viruses and most recently the flu. It also explored experimental therapies for rare diseases. Last year, the company laid off more than 800 workers, a tenth of its workforce. It also lost more than $700 million in contracts to develop a shot to protect humans against bird flu after the Trump administration canceled the agreements. The company shelved vaccines to protect against herpes, chickenpox, and shingles. Even though it had started years before the pandemic, Moderna's work on mRNA cancer vaccines flew relatively under the radar. In addition to the experimental cancer vaccine it is developing with Merck, Moderna solely owns several others that it is testing in different cancers. People started to pay attention as Moderna and Merck began presenting promising results from mid-stage clinical research, said Andrew Tsai, an analyst at the Wall Street bank Jefferies. Now, Moderna is back in the spotlight. Crucial questions remain with the promising results in melanoma, which has repeatedly proved to be more responsive to treatment. Hold up in cancers that are tougher to treat. And will the detailed results look as good as the companies make them sound on Wednesday? The drug maker said they would present the full data soon at a medical meeting. But now that an mRNA cancer vaccine appears to have succeeded, Dr. Van Buren of TD Cowen said he anticipated that drug makers would flock into the technology. Now that this trial was successful, he said, I definitely think we can expect more investment by other pharma companies. Okay, next article. More of Trump's chosen candidates fall in GOP primaries. A series of recent losses has eroded the president's winning record, raising new questions about his hold over the party's voters. This spring, President Trump easily dispensed with Republicans who had crossed him in a display of raw power that seemed to underscore his iron grip on the party's base. One by one, Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Representative Tom Massey of Kentucky, and Senator John Cornyn of Texas all fell to challengers backed by Trump. The spring of retribution, however, has given way to a more complicated summer. A series of losses by Trump-endorsed candidates has eroded his winning record, raising fresh questions about whether a president approaching lame duck status can still exert as much control as he wants over his party's voters. Here are some of those races. When voters and candidates ignore the president, Mr. Trump sees himself as a kingmaker who can elevate a candidate above the pack. That was not what happened on Tuesday night in Florida's 19th congressional district. There, the president picked Catalina Loeff, a Florida transplant aligned with the Make America Healthy Again movement, only to see her lose to a local media mogul, Jim Schwartzel. His seal of approval was also not enough to prop up Representative Corey Mills of Florida, whose campaign for re-election floundered under a cloud of investigations involving his treatment of women. Mr. Trump endorsed Mr. Mills in February. On Wednesday, after Mr. Mills lost to a former local news anchor, the president posted on Truth Social that he had tried to persuade Mr. Mills to drop out of the race, but was unable to do so. Mr. Mills is not the only lawmaker Mr. Trump has been unable to push out of a campaign. Another embattled ally, Representative Max Miller of Ohio, also shrugged off the president's warnings about his scandal-plagued run for re-election. And one more loyalist, Representative Andy Ogles of Tennessee, lost his bid for re-election this month after he faced a backlash for anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant remarks. Trouble in governor's races. The president has particularly struggled this year to pick winners in governor's races. His initial picks have lost in five statewide contests in recent months. In Wyoming on Tuesday night, a rancher and veterinarian who promised to lower the temperature of the state's intra-party brawls beat a Trump-backed candidate who vowed to stock the state government with bulldogs. Last week, the election denier Mike Lindell fell short in his Trump-supported bid to be the Republican nominee for governor in Minnesota. Earlier in the summer, candidates who Trump endorsed faltered in governor's races in Iowa and Georgia, His initial pick for governor lost in South Carolina, too. Trump has, however, picked the winners in key battlegrounds for governor. A longtime ally, Representative Andy Biggs, handily beat a more moderate Republican in Arizona. And the president's pick for governor in Michigan, John James, will face Jocelyn Bessent, the Secretary of State, in November. Another test in South Carolina. Senator Darlene Graham of South Carolina, who was appointed by Governor Henry McMaster to temporarily fill the vacancy left open by the death of her brother, Lindsey Graham, is running for a full term with the support of Mr. Trump. But she did not earn enough votes to avoid a runoff and had a rocky debate performance on Tuesday night. Mr. Trump is headed to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, to campaign for her on Friday. Okay, one more article for today. When depression resists treatment, if multiple antidepressants haven't helped, there are other avenues to explore. When Juan Rivera was in college, he noticed that the activities he loved, such as going out with friends, had stopped making him happy. I would be with my friends, but not enjoy it fully and just sort of feeling flat, he said. On bad days, he could barely get out of bed, much less summon the motivation to leave the house. Mr. Rivera, now 35, discussed his struggles with a psychiatrist. She evaluated him, diagnosed him with depression, and prescribed an antidepressant. It didn't work. Over the next few years, she prescribed several others, but those didn't help him either. Mr. Rivera, an immigration attorney in Miami, suffers from what most clinicians would call treatment-resistant depression. There is no broadly accepted definition of the condition, and there can be various degrees of treatment resistance, said Dr. Gerald Sanarkar, director of the Yale Depression Research Program. But many doctors, he said, consider depression to be treatment resistant if a person has not experienced at least a 50% improvement after trying two different antidepressants in such, each for 4 to 6 weeks. Despite its name, treatment-resistant depression can improve and even be cured, experts say. A number of therapies, often in combination, have been shown to help. So why depression can resist treatment? Various factors may increase the likelihood that a person with depression won't respond to initial drug treatments, said Dr. Deborah Kahn, director of the Advanced Psychiatric Therapeutics Clinic at UC Davis Health. People with a history of childhood trauma can experience depression that is more difficult to treat, she said. When those with depression have also have anxiety, certain vitamin deficiencies, thyroid disease, heart disease, or sleep apnea, they may also struggle to improve, in part because these conditions can cause depression-like symptoms such as fatigue. Genetic differences may also shape the likelihood that depression will become treatment-resistant, Dr. Kahn added. A 2025 study reported that genetic predisposition of insomnia and certain forms of neuroticism increase the risk. A person's expectations may also shape outcomes, said Dr. Senacora said. If someone has tried several medications without improving, that person may understandably not expect much from the next one. An estimated 31% of people in the United States who are treated for depression are considered treatment resistant. What doctors may try next. There's no one-size-fits-all approach to managing treatment-resistant depression. At the UC Davis Clinic, if patients don't improve after trying two antidepressants in succession and undergoing psychotherapy, they may be prescribed a low dose of an additional drug, such as an atypical antipsychotic or lithium, said Dr. Kahn. Clinicians will ensure that medical problems that could be contributing to symptoms are addressed too. One additional therapy that has been shown to help people with treatment-resistant depression is transaxial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, which was cleared by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for treatment of depression in 2008. Dr. Khan said it uses magnetic pulses to stimulate parts of the brain to increase mood-boosting chemicals, including neuropropylene, dopamine, and serotonin, she said. TMS is tolerated well and has no long-term serious side effects, Dr. Khan said. A 2023 meta-analysis of 19 clinical trials found that patients who received TMS while taking an antidepressant were 2.8 times as likely to experience remission compared with people who took an antidepressant while receiving a sham TMS treatment as a placebo. Ketamine, an anesthesia commonly used in surgery, is increasingly used to address treatment-resistant depression. In 2019, the FDA approved Spravato, an intranasal spray containing ketamine. In a 2019 trial, 52.5% of patients with treatment-resistant depression who took esketamine with an antidepressant for 28 days experienced a significant resolution of their symptoms compared with about 31% of people who took an antidepressant with a placebo. Ketamine is thought to work in part by helping the brain form new or stronger connections in networks involved in mood and cognition, said Dr. Khan. Psychedelic medicines, including psilocybin, ibogaine, and 5-MeO-DMT, which are thought to work in similar ways, are also being studied as potential treatments, she said. Mr. Rivera, the immigration lawyer, recently began taking intranasal Spravato, and he started feeling better after his second session. The medication is helping lift the negative filter, he said, that permeates his thoughts and mood. That said, there is unlikely to be one magic pill that cures treatment-resistant depression, Dr. Khan said. People may benefit from a combination of approaches, and they may also need to combine treatments with lifestyle changes. Dr. Sanacora said he always asks his patients what they plan to do over the upcoming weekend to ensure they're active and seeking out joy, he said. You can take the medicine, but you also have to do the other physical and social interventions that are so important. Okay, so you've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 20th issue of the New York Times. Your reader today has been Mark Reier. Thank you so much for listening.